for many people, not just myself, that would lead to taking something of some form to make it feel better, to make it feel better. But until we can really rest in the truth of life is, our lives are going to be unmanageable. And you don't necessarily have to be an alcoholic or a cocaine junkie or a food addict. Life will still be uncomfortable because that's what life is. This is how addiction works. But before we can do anything about it, and I know all of you have seen this, before we can do anything about it, we have to see what's actually going on here. Somewhere along the line, we have to see or get the message that this isn't working, whatever the this is. And this, again, doesn't have to be just about addiction. It could be in other parts in our life when we want a particular relationship to work a particular way at a particular time. It doesn't always happen that way. And I don't know about you, but I've heard a lot of people say, and I've heard myself say about life, why is this happening to me? Well, why shouldn't it be happening to you? Or is there something I'm doing that's getting it to be happening to me? So there's some very deep questions here. It is a very good question, why is this happening to me, if we're really able and willing to look at what might be going on. What might be going on? It's true, separate from addiction, that heinous things happen in life. Things that are unfair, things that are very, very difficult, things that are beyond our control. And just as with the other, first we have to see, where can we take some control? Is there something we can do? And then learn how to be with what's happening. So this first step, I think, is an important step about life, not just about the life of the addict. So program starts with step one. If we were fortunate, before we got too sick, we admitted we were powerless and our lives had become unmanageable. Sometimes it takes a longer time to get to that. And when I sit here and I'm sitting with all of you and I'm just so grateful that at one point, I guess about 39 years ago, I felt pummeled. And I said, I don't know, I can't do this. I didn't know what else I could do. I wasn't at the place of coming to admit anything. It was just more, I can't do this. I can't live like this. And there was a part of me, thank God, that wanted to live. And so when a psychiatrist, you know, usually think of psychiatrists just giving out meds. When a psychiatrist said to me one day, when I thought he would give me another antidepressant, he said, you know, Sandra, I think it's time for you to go to AA. The best medicine any doctor has ever given me. And I'm really grateful I took it. I'm really grateful I took it. In the program, we talk a lot about denial, of course. And the Buddha talked about ignorance. And they're very much the same. The Buddha talked about ignorance as the source of our suffering. It doesn't simply mean not knowing the facts, okay? Ignorance means ignoring. I love that. It's so simple, right? How many of us kind of knew we were in deep trouble with what was going on? And it was like, yeah, but maybe I'll try something else. Anything but face the real problem. And ignoring is a dynamically charged ignorance. A dynamically charged ignorance, a not wanting to know. Right? Did you have that when you started to realize that whatever you were using or doing wasn't working in your behalf? There's a part of you like, I don't want to know that. And this may be bad, but knowing it is even worse. There's a resistance to knowing, not allowing ourselves to see what's really going on. It doesn't only have to be about addiction. You could probably see it in different parts of your life. You can maybe see it. I mean, other people have seen it. I've seen it in relationships. Not wanting to know the relationship wasn't working. Not wanting to know that my plans to travel around the world on a shoestring wasn't such a good idea. Not wanting all these things that we don't want to know. But boy, how much we can learn when we finally say, well, okay, this is what's happening. Now what? Now what? So there's a website called 12step.org. Why not? Step one is the first step to freedom. I admit to myself that something is seriously wrong. Something is not working. And I think that's, sometimes they call it step zero, right? There's something going on, but I can't quite put my finger on it, or I don't want to put my finger on it. There's a mess going on in my life. I admit I've been playing games with myself and I'm losing the game. I see that my life has become unmanageable in many ways. It's not under my control anymore. I do things that I later regret doing and I tell myself I will not do it again. Anybody have that? Not only about addiction. But I do. I keep on doing them in spite of my regrets, my denials, my vows, my cover-ups, my facades. The addiction has become bigger than I am. The first step is to admit the truth of where I am, that I'm really powerless over this particular addiction and that I need help. And then whoever wrote this put in parentheses, even though I might not yet be willing to accept the help that's so available. As I really like that. So the word addiction is used to describe an occurring compulsion that an individual keeps engaging in some specific activity of whatever sort, despite harmful consequences. And sometimes we see the harmful consequences early on. And sometimes we don't see it till we're either in jail or in a hospital or somebody's planting a flower on our grave. But we beat that one, that's for sure, right? I was very moved when I looked up the word addict. Addict. It means to devote or give oneself over habitually or compulsively. I like that, to devote oneself. I was very devoted. I remember there was a man I really liked, and one day he said to me, Sandra, I really love you, but I can't see a life with you if you're going to keep on drinking. And I said, I understand, but I was so devoted that we broke up. I never did see him again. He was wise. He was wise. But here's the eye opener. This is what I like. The Latin addictus, okay, I thought that I walk around speaking Latin, but means given over as one awarded to another as a slave. Anybody here see the movie 12 Years a Slave? Oh my God, what a powerful film. But more than a powerful film, the amazing injustices and pain that so many people face. Do you ever think of yourself as a slave? When I saw that, I mean, it just pulled me back. The Buddha spoke a lot about desire, attachment, grasping, clinging, and he used the word tanha. It's an interesting word. Tanha means an unquenchable thirst or desire. Sorry, an unquenchable desire, but I just relate to that unquenchable thirst. It didn't seem to matter how sick I got. I just one more. I remember once, soon before I came into program, and my mother was very sick, and my brother and I were having dinner, and we each ordered a drink, and I drank my drink, and I'm looking at his drink. It's sitting there. He took a sip, I couldn't understand a word he said. Finally, I said, you know, before you get back in the car, maybe you need to go to the men's room. I just wanted him to leave so I could finish his drink. And finish it, I did. But this kind of tanha, it's like being so thirsty and drinking salt water. Nothing that we do when there's this tanha is going to quench the thirst. I think that's a very graphic description of addiction. No matter how much you take or where you take or what kind of fancy clothes you're wearing, when you take it, it's going to do the same thing. Eastern or Western, the Buddha or Bill W., it's all about seeking and trying to hold on to pleasure and avoid pain. And addicts, alcoholics, not the only ones who try to do that. I think our society is geared. Take the pill, you don't have to feel any pain. Buy the car, then you definitely won't feel any pain until you have to pay for it. But that's a whole other story. And with addiction, we pay. And we pay a lot. So addiction is this grasping or clinging to a substance or a behavior. It wrecks lives. It wrecks families all around the world. Nobody gets off scot-free. But here's the thing now. The Buddha spoke of an even deeper and more subtle addiction. And this is one that is really hard to break. It's the addiction to I, me, mine. I, me, mine. And we teach kids that very early, which is kind of cute with a kid. You know, they have a little toy or something and they go, mine. And the parents go, look at that, that's so wonderful. He knows, I say, mine. And then when you're 30, 40, 50, 60, mine. I, me, mine. And what happens is we just ignore. I mean, look around the room. There's a room of I, me, mines here. But what a different world it is when we say we. It's a different world. And a lot of times we do say we, but there's an awful lot of me. An awful lot of me. There is this addiction. I mean, I'm the most important person in my life. And yes, I am. I don't have children. But that doesn't mean I'm the most important person in your life. I give it back to you, my dear. The addiction to self. Because come with that is the need to control. That's what kings and queens did, right? I own all of you. The need to control. Feeling entitled and almost like there's an imperative to control. Think about your life, how much you try to control. And how much is not in your control. And if you're in a relationship with a friend or a spouse or a lover or a doorman or whatever, notice where control comes in. Because it works on many levels. Sometimes it's like belligerent. And sometimes it's very, very subtle. But controlling, needing to control to feel safe. Because of our species, we all want to feel safe, of course. But a lot of what we do to feel safe can be very harmful to someone else. I just look around the world. Or to ourselves, or to ourselves. So then we enter into this addictive behavior and substance and what have you. It's a response to feeling unsafe, and in the moment of taking whatever it is you take or do, there's a moment of safe. Gosh, I remember how many times when everybody left my apartment or whatever, and I poured that drink, and that first, it was like, okay, now I'm okay. Now, if I had stopped after that, I would have been fine. But by the time I got ready to go to bed, I wasn't feeling okay anymore. Not at all. Not at all. So I read this here last year, right? But I love it, and so please bear with me, maybe you forgot. Grasping at things can only yield one of two results. This is by Goenka, a marvelous Buddhist teacher. Grasping at things can only yield one of two results. Either the thing you are grasping at disappears, or you yourself disappear. It's only a matter of which occurs first. Is that cool? So the Buddha's teachings on the Four Noble Truths are an expansion of this idea of the willingness to see what's true, and then learning how to be present with what's true. That's step one. That's step one. The first noble truth is that life, this universality, brings this universality of suffering that he calls dukkha. And dukkha is an interesting word, and it has a lot of different meanings. It can mean, it includes impermanence, dissatisfaction, imperfect, subject to change, affliction, and stress, and what have you. So I'll just use the word dukkha. I think it says it so well. You ever, those of you who have been studying or being with the Buddha's teachings, do you ever sometimes just say to you, whoa, this is dukkha. This is dukkha. And there are all levels of dukkha. Like I see something in Lord and Taylor that's really beautiful and it's $500. That's dukkha. When I get out of the store without having bought it, that's sukha. That's happiness. But I see a lot of dukkha just around. Just have to look on the street. Even before you turn on the television and see the suffering. The suffering that's all around. The Buddha taught over and over again, there's a lot of stuff that's going to, I don't think he used the word stuff, right? It's a lot of stuff that's going to happen in our lives and we can't do anything about it. But here's his main teaching, or big teaching. We do have control over how we relate to this. How we relate to what's happening in our lives. And this is key. And maybe you can compare for yourself ways you related while you were using or drinking and ways you relate to different things now. And we have choices. We have a lot of choices with that. So, the Buddha said life is unsatisfactory. He didn't say there was no joy. He didn't say you can't have a good time in life. But life is unsatisfactory because things are constantly changing. You can't hold on to what you really want. You can't get rid of what you don't want. It's got nothing to do with where you were born or how old you are or how many college degrees you have. That's just the way it goes. And there is going to be sickness, and there is going to be old age if you're lucky. And there is going to be death because it's all part of the package. How do we learn to be with it? And so just to come back to step one, I mean, there's nothing pessimistic about it. It's just true. You know, in step one, it might say we were powerless over alcohol. It made our lives unmanageable. Well, we're, in a sense, powerless over a lot of what life has to offer. And if we try to control it, it can make our lives unmanageable. How we relate will make all the difference. So in step one, it's huge. We surrender to the truth of our addiction. But not just surrender to the truth of our addiction, we're also saying, okay, I'm powerless over this. It's not working. My life is unmanageable, and maybe there's something I can do. I remember the first time I went to a meeting, I was stunned by hearing people happy. Did anybody have that when they first went to a meeting and people are laughing and they're happy? And I thought, well, maybe I'll come back. Maybe I'll come back. And fortunately, the meeting I went to was across the street from me, so I didn't have to pass a bar or a store or anything to get there. Amazing, amazing. The Buddha expands this to our whole life. I mean, like we come into the program, we take that first step, and then the other steps, little by little, they give us this new life. I remember, bless you. I remember I was so besotted by the steps that I was doing step 12 like a week after I came into the program. And I was in a car with my sister-in-law, my brother, and I was telling them, look, I know you're not alcoholics, but you really got to come to AA meetings. You got to come because, oh my God, they are so wonderful. They tell you what you can do, what you can't do, how things are impossible, and then they and my brother, thank God, they just go, oh, wow, son, I'm so happy this is working for you. They didn't make me get out of the car, which would have been a problem. I was in Florida with them, so. Yeah. But that excitement when you go, whoa, there is a way of life. And I have to say, I felt that same excitement when I started to learn some of the Buddha's teachings, when I started to look at the Eightfold Path, when I started to read more, and I went, oh, there's real peace. I can have peace of mind and body. And when I put those two of them together, that combination of the 12-step program and the Buddha's teachings, way before we started anything like this here, it was like, how fortunate can I be? It's all there. It's really astonishing. And the Buddha saw dukkha as something not to be shunned. He didn't say run away from dukkha. No. He said acknowledge it and explore it. If you're upset about something, it's not about only how do I get not upset, but what's going on that I'm so upset? What got triggered in me? What's happening? And those questions that you give to yourself can be very powerful, can learn a great deal. And then you can pay yourself $200 as if you're your own therapist, and that's great. Yeah. He believed that denial of suffering contributed to more suffering. Clinging to needing things a certain way, certainly to be dukkha. You know, I'm a therapist, so I hear myself a lot. Not me talking, but whoever's sitting at the couch. I'm very familiar because I either say the same things or I have the same feelings. We're all human. But how many times somebody will say, oh, I met the greatest guy. I love him. And two sessions later, I don't know what's wrong with him. Why he has to put his shoes on here and why he doesn't do this. And then, I don't know, why does he have to talk to me when I'm trying to rest? Why does he have to? And then four sessions later, we broke up. It wasn't working. How many times have we said, it's not working? Instead of, am I contributing here anyway? And maybe it's not working, but is there something I'm also doing? The other thing is, if you pay attention, and here's where meditation is so important. You know, when people first sit to meditate, they want everything to be quiet because they think that's what's supposed to happen. Well, if you're lucky, it doesn't happen right away. And so you get to see what's running us, me, you, maybe you. Yeah. Because if we don't see it and we can't name it, we're not going to be able to do anything with it. And what the Buddha says a lot is so often it's not so much what's going on that's so bad, it's our commentary on what's going on. Have you ever taken a little thing and turned it into a big thing? I can do that. But have you ever taken a big thing and little by little shrunk it down to a little thing? that's also possible. So the Buddha taught in Alcoholics Anonymous, the program teaches, there are times that we are powerless over what is going on in our life as alcoholics, addicts, and what have you. We learn that we are powerless over whatever the substance is or the behavior. But we're not helpless because we can choose not to use it, and then we get power. Then we're empowered. It's what we choose. And a key element here is the need to surrender and to know, surrender what to what. I love Kevin Griffin is so great. By the way, as you may know, the ego does not like to surrender because the ego likes to be in control. And we have so much more control when we surrender. It's really funny how that works. So Kevin Griffin wrote, before we can begin to realize our potential, we must break out of the limiting concepts of who and what we are and what we think is possible. Those limiting concepts. So we have to be willing to take an honest look. Have I talked too much here? Never? Yeah, sometimes. Thank you. Sure. A key element here is the need to surrender. The ego does not like to surrender. So in a breath at a time, Kevin Griffin, before we can begin to realize our potential, we must break out of limiting concepts of who and what we are and what we think is possible. I don't remember who said it, but somebody wrote something really marvelous that even though sometimes we think we're scared of doing something, but a lot of what we're really scared about is how big we could become. We might also be scared of our power. It's almost easier to stay small. It's an interesting thing to consider. So, an article I saw, admitting powerlessness is absolutely essential to breaking the addiction cycle, and it talks about 5 points. One, pain. That's where it starts. Pain. Goes to reaching out to an addictive agent such as work, food, sex, alcohol, or dependent relationships to take care of our pain. So this is the pre-addiction pain. Leads to pain. Leads to temporary anesthesia, leads to negative consequences, leads to shame and guilt, which result in more pain and low self-esteem. And it just keeps going on and on and on. Buddha said, I have tried to escape from suffering by every means known to man. I have tested all the prescriptions to their very limits and have found them wanting. There is no escape from existential affliction. If we're going to have a life, here's a Yiddish word, we're going to have tzuras. Not too many Jews in the room, right? We're going to have problems. So our path is not always to get rid of all the stuff, but how we relate with our thoughts, with our actions, with our minds, how we relate. I think I've said that 6 times already tonight, and it's really big. But before we relate, we have to be aware. We have to know what's going on. We have to know what's ours, what somebody else's. We have to know where we can intervene and where we have to step back. And sometimes we need guidance with all of that. And so often, if we can just take a deep breath and say, just this. Feeling pissed right now. That's what it is, just feeling pissed. Feeling like a craving. Okay, that's what it is. Just this. Just knowing what we're feeling, how we're feeling. So in the next months, we are going to continue looking at the different steps and the Buddha's teachings and giving us a sense of how we can possibly, if we are into it, take these two brilliant directions and create our path for ourselves. It's not about if you do one path, you can't have the other path. No, they blend beautifully. They blend beautifully. And nobody has to be one way. You know, that's what's so beautiful. There's room for each of us to express ourselves in our own way. But one thing is true, whether it's with the 12-step program or the Buddha's teachings, if we will approach it with diligence, with open-mindedness, we will know happiness, we will know well-being, and we'll gain more strength and we'll gain more courage. But it's not going to happen just from reading a book and underlining, or listening to a talk. Somehow, I like when they say path, to get from one part of a path to another part of the path, one step at a time. So, thank you all, and I'm really looking forward to...
I have to start having a pencil, because when she talks, I always think, oh, yeah. And then by the time it's my turn to talk, I have the thought in my head. Except, of course, that doesn't mean I can't talk. Yeah, I came back from a three-month retreat. We were silent for 3 months, and there was some talking because we talked to teachers and we were yogi jobs. And I was just, I couldn't concentrate because I was so full of self-hate. I was so full of regret, all the people I hated and hurt. I mean, there was nowhere else to go. You know, I couldn't go get a milkshake or run or do all the stuff you do so you don't have to feel the shit. So I'm sitting there, and all this terrible shit was happening all over again. All the terrible shit that's ever happened was happening all over again. I'm sitting, I had nowhere to run. But I couldn't cry. And I'm a big weeper. I came into this program weeping. I just wept. And I couldn't cry this time. And what that did, I don't even know where this came from. This is what I was going to say. But what happened was, because I didn't have the drama of crying, I had to look at them. I had to look at the actions. I had to look at the people. I looked at the hurt. And I was able to have room for compassion and forgiveness in my part. And I saw some things that I had never seen before. It was amazing. And I also saw how the drama kept me from that. Like the liquor kept me from that. You know, and I knew we were going to have this talk, and I kept thinking about how the Buddha and Bill W. were the same, but also how they're different. Because the Buddha talks about renunciation, but he talks about renunciation. He said you will renounce the bad thing when you see the good thing. When you'll see how good it is on the other side, you'll give up the bad thing. I had no idea there was anything good on the other side. We didn't give it up because it was going to be wonderful to be sober. We're going to sit in a room someday in some basement. I was here long enough ago smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee in the basement. It wasn't that. I walked in the room and people were laughing and I decided to stay, but I didn't come because it was better on the other side. I didn't come because of this life that I have now. If I'd have known about this life, I may have at least been interested in exploring, but I gave it up because it hurt too much. And the other thing that I think is different is there's a lot of judgment in the program, and it may be necessary. It may be necessary because if I'm not bad, maybe I won't change. You don't call me bad. If I don't name myself a bad person, maybe I won't be willing to change. The Buddha doesn't do that. It's not about being bad. You know, I love the sense, one of the things the Buddha says, or one of the things I hear is, relax, observe, allow. Not work, figure it out, and change. You know, it's not what we do in AA. In AA, it's like, figure it out, do the steps, you know, change yourself, figure out how you can change. Oh, I think we're not supposed to do it like that, but that's how I did it. That's why you have a sponsor and you have the room so you can learn how to give yourself a break. But the Buddha's real clear, relax, observe, allow. And I love that. And that came to me while I was sitting, there was a lot of that when I was struggling. one of my teachers said that, and it just changed it opened up my heart, you know. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that worked, and I'm going to stop it.
Don't stop.
The other thing that worked for me was the love that I get in mm-hmm. these rooms and in the Sangha. I have a teacher, Gloria Terania, always says, feel it, feel it. That's how she teaches, you know, feel it. And I remember when I was leaving, and I spoke on the seventh step at the step meeting, and I told them I was going on a 3-month retreat, and they were like, wow, we love you. That's so fabulous. And so when I was sitting there hating myself, I kept thinking, feel it. They love you. Feel it. Those are smart people. Those are people that know you. Because I have sat in that room in the third step and the seventh step and the eighth, you know, and told them my shit. Mm. They knew me and they loved me. Mm. So it was real important to take what I learned in AA to that cushion when I was feeling that self-hate and say, feel it. You know, so you don't feel it. And you know, what they tell you, let us love you till you love yourself. Mm. All of that happened because I was willing to come in here because it hurt so bad. Mm. I didn't think I was going to get well. I just didn't want to die that day. Luckily, I came in that day I didn't want to die, because a lot of times I did want to die. But that day, there was a moment when the sky opened up and I wanted to live, and I walked in here. And I was powerless. I didn't believe I was powerless. I believed I was going to learn how to drink so I wouldn't have to stop. And I smoked reefer for 6 months before I gave that up. And I knew my life was unmanageable. I knew my life was unmanageable in bits and pieces. I didn't know overall. You were talking about my ex-husband made contact with me, as I told you, last year. And he said he remembers, he taught me how to drink, because I was drinking rum and coke when I met that fool. And he said he remembers he ordered a drink, and he looked over and I had two, and he ordered another drink and I had three more. And he was like, you know, he didn't understand what's going on. What was going on was an alcoholic was coming alive. Was you know, he had watered the seed, and I was mm-hmm. I was growing.
You're so funny.
So that's how it happens, and that's what the first step is. It's like all of us are laughing because we realize that we could find you know, we could find light, and all of us hurt. We came here because of the pain. I can say that in here, you know. That's what the beautiful thing about this program, and the beautiful thing about the Buddhism, about the Dharma for me, is I have a Sangha, which is like this. Mm. When I came back, some of the people who were on retreat with me showed up at one of the sits here, and we were so happy to see each other, because when I tell people, I learned that when things come into my mind when I'm meditating, it's just a thought. Mm. Like that self-hate, that's one of the things that helped. It's just a thought. Self-hate, just because I believe it and it seems real clear to me, it doesn't make it true. The self-hate is just a thought. And when I told somebody that, and I said, it freed me, she was like, yeah, but thoughts are important. Because she wasn't into it. She was like, an intellectual. She's a smarty pants. So she wasn't my people. But when I sat in this room and I talked to people about thoughts, they understood. So the Sangha and AA, the fellowship, are critical. That's how I maintain my sobriety and my sanity in this world, is I have you guys and I have my Sangha, which I feel like in the same way. I feel the same connection. Yeah. So thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, that's cool. If I had a car, I would have left that retreat. It was too far. It was in Massachusetts. I could have driven away.
I had the joy of, I was able to be there for about 10 or 12 days, and I was sitting in back of you, off to the side. Mm. Yeah. And it just felt so good, you know, seeing people I knew walking, sitting, eating, walking. And I remember when I left, I wanted to come over and hug you and say goodbye. And I was like, you don't hug somebody on retreat. Yeah. We are so fortunate. None of us are dead. We're very, very fortunate. And again, I'd like to just throw out that you perhaps read step one, contemplate step one, not only in terms of addiction, but in terms of your life. And look and see, is there any unmanageability in your life? And what is your participation in it? Or what you could do differently?
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.